top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
Strange case. No sign of violence, yet she looks completely contorted in fear. Almost as if she'd been frightened to death. As if she'd seen something too horrible to live through.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more. From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 229, When a Stranger Calls.
Right.
Audible sigh. Reluctantly, we're revisiting this, not in the watching sense, but in the recording sense, because it had to happen. It was an inevitability that we discussed, and it had never happened to us, and we lost the entire podcast due to a technical malfunction.
We recorded it earlier, and it was pretty good from what I can recall. And due to technical difficulties, it was lost into the ether. So we are re-recording it without notes, because we both read our notes after we were finished recording what we thought would be the podcast that would be aired, that you're listening to right now. But no notes, so here we go.
And we've also increased the distance between the time we last watched it as well. So
exactly.
It's a double whammy.
Yeah, but hopefully we can make something listenable. I think we can. So, When a Stranger Calls. First of all, this is another film that I had never seen prior to watching it for the podcast. And there are two reasons for that. Number one is because the urban legend that this is based around, frankly, scared the absolute shit out of me when I was a kid. Number two, thinking about that urban legend, to me, that's the makings of a short film. How in the God's name can you stretch it out to 90 minutes? Well, this film kind of shows you that you can't. And we'll just talk about that in a moment or two. But first, let's talk about the urban legend. Everybody knows the legend, the callers in the house.
Threatening phone calls, typically to a babysitter or someone home alone. They keep calling back. Eventually, after they won't take no for an answer, the victim phones the police. The police trace the call and find out that it's coming from the house. Mm-hmm. Dun, dun, dun.
Now,
terrifying stuff.
The reason why this scared the absolute living daylights out of me is because, as a child, I was left home with many a babysitter, my sister and I, seeing as I was raised by a single mother who had an active social life. So she would go out often and we'd have babysitters. And I remember when I first heard this legend, this urban legend, I was actually in summer camp. I was in a sleepover camp. You know, we're now in the midst of summer, and it was probably around this time of year. I was in my bottom bunk. I never got the top bunk. Everyone always wanted the top bunk. I never got the top bunk. Why did everyone always want the top bunk?
Because it's a predator prey relationship. It's like a hawk scanning the open field for a rodent. I don't know.
We don't want the bottom bunk because we're afraid that someone's gonna piss on us. But then again, being on the top bunk, I mean, that comes with its own set of fears. I mean, what if I roll over and fall off? You know. So bottom bunk. Counselors are regaling us with this tale. And because of the fact that, this is an everyday occurrence for me, being left alone with babysitters, it scared the shit out of me. I remember the climax of the tale was, and then she went into the room, and she discovered the two kids mutilated. And I had never heard that word before. And I asked my counselor, I said, what does that mean, mutilated? And his answer was chopped up into a million tiny little pieces. And for some reason, that image that popped in my head was so fundamentally disturbing, of somebody basically made into minced meat, that it just completely fucked me up psychologically. And that's probably why I was afraid of my own child for many years. Now, this film takes that urban legend. We have a babysitter played by Carol Kane, and she plays a babysitter by the name of Jill. And she is asked to come to the house of a couple by the name of The Mandrakises. The Mandrakises. Is that correct? Yeah?
That's all Greek to me.
And, yep, exactly. And she's told that the kids are already asleep, help yourself to anything in the fridge, don't you worry. So she goes about making herself comfortable, and of course the phone rings, and the caller on the other end says, have you checked the children? In a sort of menacing way, and that's all he says. And at first, of course, is, well, who is this? Is this Bobby? Is this my boyfriend? Blah, 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 you know? And then, of course, the call comes again and says, yeah, okay, what are you doing? I'm going to call the police, et cetera, et cetera. And he kept on saying, have you checked the children? And what made me laugh was that she was doing everything but checking the children, you know? Mm-hmm. She was calling other people. She was looking in the fridge. She was doing this. All she had to do was walk towards the bedroom.
She eventually did look out the window to see if someone might have been stalking her. So eventually, well, she didn't check the children. She checked the window, and then she checked the children.
But, I mean, she was given one simple direction. Well, check the children. And that the caller incessantly kept calling again. And then this is a bravura scene. I mean, the first 20 minutes of this film are phenomenal. Of course, if it sounds familiar, it's because Wes Craven, an admitted big fan of the opening 20 minutes of this film, sort of took that and played on it with Scream, with Drew Barrymore getting off in the opening 20 minutes, being home alone, etc. So, having been given this simple direction, but yet not following it, doing other things, calling the police, etc., she ultimately finds out that the killer, because they trace a call, the killer is in the house. And by that time, it's too late. They don't show the grisly aftermath of the murder.
Wasted opportunity.
Well, I was going to say whether fortunately or unfortunately, but you do see the horrific look on her face. A quick aftermath saying that she survived, but she's not doing too well in the head. And then after that, crackerjack 20 minutes, we flash forward 7 years later, and this is where the film starts to develop a few problems.
Yeah, I mean, what a wasted opportunity. All this amazing capital built up and this wonderful bravura, great word, set up. But I guess that explains why a movie like Urban Legend used multiple mm-hmm. urban legends to forward its plot. And this one, yeah, there's nowhere to go from here. This would have been a wonderful short, beautiful 20 minutes, taut, superb. As soon as the time passes, it just like deflates it completely, and it just turns into this, wrote by the book, thin blue line cop caper, and that's just not what I was invested in, because I hadn't seen it either, mm-hmm. but we have both referenced it on the podcast, so as like a kind of a communal joke within the horror community. It's a bit like almost Das Boot in a way. It's like, oh, the submarine movie no one's seen. It's like, it's the movie we all should have seen but haven't. And it,
well, I mean, this film did do good business when it came out in 79 mm-hmm. in the wake of Halloween. I mean, horror was pretty hot at the time. In fact, this movie got a lot of unfair comparisons to Halloween. They said that in many ways, it copied the template, but no, I think that's...
somewhat POV, they have a babysitter getting menaced, barely, not exactly...
Barely.
The lunatic in the asylum, but that's about exactly, it, I mean, exactly. Yeah.
No, honestly, this film is about as far from Halloween as you can get it. I mean, just compare the two killers. You have the hulking, menacing, silent, methodical Michael Myers with that wonderful mask versus this twerp who...
Kirk Duncan.
Who gets his ass kicked. Yeah,
even midway, a terrible name, a milquetoast name.
Yeah, Kirk Duncan gets his ass kicked in a bar midway through the film. And, are we supposed to pity this guy? Because he's a bit imbalanced. He was given 38 electroshock therapies, and now he's at a bar trying to creep on some aged barfly woman.
Well, if you're going to make him sympathetic, you've got to do it from the get-go. You can't just midway through play the sympathy card mm-hmm. and expect to extract any, that was ridiculous. Mm-hmm. But
so, okay, 7 years later. So we don't know what has happened to Joe, but we know that she survived. There were two cops that were sort of on the case. One was a cop played by Ron O'Neill, who we both love in Superfly. We didn't love him so much in this film. He didn't have a lot to do. The other one played by the great Charles Durning. Now, I'm using IMDb now for my notes. Plays a cop named Clifford. And in the ensuing 7 years, he retires from the beat and becomes a private investigator. And he's hired by the Mr. Mandrakis by Mr. Mandrakis to find the killer, because the killer was found, but he was found innocent on the grounds of insanity, sent to a sanitarium. They obviously they had some more lax security procedures. He escaped, just like Michael Myers did. So there's a comparison right there. And then we follow two narrative threads. We follow the thread of Clifford trying to find the killer. For some reason, 7 years later, all of a sudden it's becoming personal to him. I don't know why. I think he mentioned at one point why.
As opposed to apprehend the killer? Him the first time, and then his work wasn't done because of the lax justice system or whatever it is, whatever you want to call it. And then he's going to be bound to recidivism, which he sort of does become. I can't. Oh my God, I'm struggling to remember some of the kills. So but he's out on the loose and he's living like a hobo on Skid Row in L.A. And
he doesn't have a penny to his name. He's got all he has is a clothes on his back, and he's, I guess, a threatening presence in the sense that, you know, like there's this woman that he's stalking. That he meets at this bar, and that results in said beatdown. So anyway, this procedural goes on, and it's not the most compelling thing. However, in the last 20 minutes of this movie, it picks up a bit, because then all of a sudden we have Carole King coming back, reprising her role, and now we get this sort of cat and mouse thing happening between her character Jill, now 7 years older with a family of her own, versus what's the killer's name again? Duncan.
Kirk. I want to say Kirk Douglas or Kirk Hammett. Yeah. Kirk Duncan.
Duncan is like a horse from The Simpsons. Like diving horse. Anyway. And so, yeah, the first 20 minutes are absolutely crackerjack, just completely essential viewing. And then the last 50 minutes are pretty damn entertaining, and it sort of wraps itself up nicely. But what comes in between is just completely inconsequential. So it's almost like we have these. It's like a reverse sandwich, you know, like in a sandwich, the middle is supposed to be the best part. I love bread. To me, bread is as good as anything else, you know. But what we got here is like two bread awesome and just slices butter. Of bread.
Yeah, and no nothing, pastrami or smoked meat.
Exactly. Nothing of any substance in between. It's a shame, because if this film would have kept that intensity, for example, let's just say Jill was the first of many victims, and he kept doing this with the same MO again and again, and the police are trying to catch him, but they can't seem to trace him, and so on. That would have made a 90-minute movie.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, well, I guess we had similar complaint about Murder by Phone, which is another using the same medium to off people, or who knows?
No, that's too totally different. He's not using a phone to kill people. He's killing people.
No, but that's the means by which you're supposedly generating frights. Uh-huh. So, yeah, it's the same thing. You have to either... You have to constantly be calling if calling is the MO of this guy. So you can't just have calls in the first quarter, calls in the last quarter, and nothing in between. So the lack of contact between the antagonist and the protagonist is, I mean, to this film's debit. Mm-hmm. And they didn't even invest anything, as I said before, into the guy's supposed being supposedly sympathetic in the way that... the notorious Christmas Evil did, where the guy hated Christmas and he was a sad sack, he lost his job, so he built up this momentum and then momentum and momentum, and then finally when Kris Kringle comes around, he snaps on that night. So that makes sense. This is just like, yeah, he's in a bar, he's depressed. It's like, well,
you can't as well you should well, be depressed. Hey, neither can I. Yeah. So, you know, fuck, man. I'm out there, exactly. You know, slaughtering kids and you're just every exactly. night, you know? But, okay, so, what I'd like to do is sort of deviate from our formula just a wee bit. What did we learn? And star rating. And then I want to talk just a bit more about urban legends in general. Mm-hmm. So, what did you learn from this film?
Well, I learned that if there was ever to be a biopic of our late mayor, the crack-smoking Rob Ford, Charles Durning is an absolute perfect dead ringer. I also learned that, man, did Ron O'Neill age badly in the years between Superfly and this movie, which would have been maybe three or four years. He's
Superfly. By little Chris Mayfield for your cover.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah, he was just like paunchy and just like...
I was singing Pusher Man. I'm your Pusher Man.
Oh, okay.
I'm your Pusher Man. How does the theme of Superfly go again? Superfly.
Dun, 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 dun. Yeah, I don't know, but yeah, he was. I guess it's just
Little Cow, running wild, singing the whole soundtrack.
Yeah, but you don't put him in cool threads or give him cool stuff to say. He just becomes this middle-aged, retiring balding cop, which is usually a sign you're about to lose your life on the job, and you get that last paycheck coming in before retirement. But here, he has to be like strong-armed and coerced at a party. where he's actually he's drunk and tending to his infant boy when the Charles Durning character gives him the, come on, man, you got to help me on this case. The guy's escaped, and he reluctantly goes back to you know, square the circle and pick up this Kirk Duncan and, provide this solace for the family. But, I mean, my God, not much going on.
Well, what I learned is that in pretty much about 250 episodes, because we've had, you know, some A's and B's and C's, back in the day when we didn't really know how we were numbering these things. The fact that we've only lost one episode, and we've always feared it each and every time we press record, I think that's pretty goddamn impressive. And
it is.
So, despite the fact that we had to re-record this, and we don't have the benefit of our notes, and our memories are a little bit longer than before, hey, you know what? We're doing our best. So, because the details are a bit foggy, okay, let me just give you my star rating for this one. Wow, 4-star opening, 3-star closing. What's in the middle is just completely
2, 1.5. Yeah, so ineffectual.
Let's just meet this in the middle and give it 3 stars. But say that it is a movie everybody should see, if only for the beginning, because I mean that was a template for Scream, and that the beginning of Scream, which so many people lauded as revolutionary, despite the fact it was already done in 1979.
Yeah, it's weird because I have many positive things to say about Scream, but it's annoying when you think about that whole discussion that Drew Barrymore has with the killer about her favorite horror movie. Like, you have this like heavy breather on the line. Who's going to entertain all this crap? And then that's when it introduced right off the bat the self-referential stuff, and where even what do they say, like, most of the Nightmare on Elm Streets were crap. I forget the line exactly. It was a self-deprecating little
jibe at
Wes Craven. And it's like, yeah, like, why would you entertain crap?
We
that was ridiculous.
We have our gripes with Scream, and we have not made them quiet. We did a podcast on Scream, which you're welcome to listen to. I think we made some valid criticisms. But we're not talking about Scream. We're talking about When a Stranger Calls. And so I want to segue from When a Stranger Calls to Urban Legends, because Urban Legends is something you and I both are somewhat fascinated by.
Yeah, for sure.
And my experience with Urban Legends are that generally they scare me. At least they did when I was a kid. Not anymore, but, you know, when I was younger, some of them scared me. I mean, some of the most terrifying ones you would hear is the one where the guy's kidney was harvested when he woke up.
Yeah, you wake up with scars in a bathtub. You have pain on your back, and then all of a sudden your organ is harvested. And I love that word. But yeah, that's a great one. I always think of the Family Guy, because there's a rather jaunty barbershop musical number about this, and it's one of the most inappropriate things I think I've ever seen on television. But you have AIDS. So you spend a night with a lady of the evening. You wake up feeling a little groggy. You go to the mirror, and in lipstick is scrawled, "You have AIDS,"
okay,
or something like that.
What
which
I
is
heard,
because utterly ridiculous.
These all get changed in the telling. I heard it was "Welcome
Broken
to the Wonderful
telephone.
World of AIDS."
Oh, okay, yeah.
But first of all, when you talked about Family Guy, I'm thinking of Team America: World Police. Everybody's got AIDS. or South Park with their wonderful episode about AIDS being funny now. Enough time has passed. We can make fun of AIDS.
Oh,
you know,
God.
That was the episode where they also ripped into Jared from Subway.
Yes.
He's like, oh, I didn't lose this weight all by myself. I had AIDS. And there was this whole misunderstanding.
Brutal stuff.
But
yeah, the absurdity of, like, generally it's a lady of the evening, but it doesn't necessarily have to be. It's got a sort of misogynistic premise.
But the
fact that you would have one sexual encounter, ostensibly a one-night stand, and then suddenly, like, how unlucky would you have to be?
For me, it was just somebody who picked up somebody in a bar and went took them home and et cetera. But again, like, back in the 80s when this urban legend obviously started gaining traction, there was so much hysteria behind AIDS and people thinking it is from kissing, from touching, what have you. The reality is, and I'm not condoning this, because, I mean, everybody should be as safe as they possibly can be, but even if somebody were to have sex with somebody that had full-blown AIDS, unprotected, that's not a guarantee you're going to get the virus.
No.
It's not a guarantee. So, silly urban legend, really a cautionary tale to get people to not engage in unprotected sex. Usually when these urban legends arise, it's there to scare youth, I think, a lot of times.
Yeah, and it's all context dependent, because this stuff, when you put it in the context of a campfire, then this just it just sends chills down my spine to think of the man with the hook for a hand. Because if you say that in an urban context, it's like, well, he's got one less hand with which to kill me. It's silly. It's so much easier to escape from a man with a hook from a hand.
The hook is on the door as they drive away.
Yeah. And then you hear the radio dispatch and that. But that's the stuff when you're looking at a roaring campfire, and to your back is nothing but empty forest. It's something chilling about that, because you're empty and you don't know what's behind you. And that I think is the most evocative and the most effective. I really could care less about the city stuff, but when I'm in the bush, that kills me.
I never found the hook for the hand that scary, even when I was a really, really scared, impressionable kid. The one that frightened me more was about the girl or the lady who goes to the gas station to get a pack of cigarettes, leaves her car door open, drives home. Meanwhile, there's a scared mental patient who's in the back seat. He's lying in wait. He ambushes her, etc. That one scared me. But there's been some crazy urban legends. I mean, my mother, I remember, was telling me that in the 60s, you know, when the beehive was all the rage, that there were urban legends that people had real beehives underneath that hair and stuff. I don't know. I mean, urban legends are great. It goes right back to the tradition of folk storytelling. Mm-hmm. These are stories. This is our narrative that we share. These tales, they may be, you know, like a lot. If you look at a lot of the original fairy tales, right? They were very, very grim, very gory. Grimm's fairy tales are, you know, some of the most disturbing stuff out there, and they were cautionary tales to keep young people in the straight and narrow. And these urban legends are the same. And I love the fact that they are disseminated orally from person to person. So like Broken Telephone, they get changed and they pick up new details, and they even cross cultures, and people start adding their own cultural flair and flavor to it. And
yeah, it also reflects, good and bad aspects about about humanity, too. There's several ones with a racial undertone there's all these different ones, and there's stuff. It generally involves like misunderstandings or deaths or just rites of passage. Mm-hmm. Like the one I inquired about, because I was such a nerd about this that I wrote to the renowned expert of urban legends, is Jan Brunvand at the University of Utah. I wrote to him and I bothered this guy with my question about sneakers thrown on hydro wires, because there's a thing behind that where it says it's either like a gang, which apparently it isn't, or it's a rite of passage when you lose your virginity. So I was like, what is it? But there's nothing behind it. So that's what I heard, and like other urban legends, I erroneously passed this thing on. So it's
I remember you telling me that. I told you that.
Yeah, and I told a cab driver that it was like when you lose your virginity, and there's nothing behind it. It has no.
Look at you spreading fake news all over.
I know. Well, it's unbelievable. I own many of Brunvand's books, and it's funny. There is like a small kernel of truth to many of these urban legends as well. So there are misunderstandings. There are. In China, there have been allegations, I think, founded that they use prisoners for unwitting organ donors. So, but the fact that you could conscript a surgeon to like drug somebody and then in their bathtub like perform this elaborate surgery with just the tools at your disposal and then ice down.
Well, maybe they got Jack the Ripper through time. Well, the ability is.
Oh, I have many more things that I've learned, actually. Oh, if you want
to, back to the film.
There's similarities to two Los Angeles. Fellow Los Angeles movies.
Los Angeles set movies.
Set movies. One is Barfly, and the other is Don't Answer the Phone, which is, you know, again, a guy roaming the streets of seedy LA. It's Skid Row, and he's the one. And to that movie's credit, he was constantly making phone calls.
You say he's the one. What is he? The one what?
Oh, the antagonist Don't Answer the Phone is making lots of calls, but when he's not making calls, then he's busy actually murdering prostitutes. So he keeps the narrative going.
Or doing some really, really bizarre, something, psychotic stuff.
Yeah, that was a really crazy movie.
That's a hidden gem. I love that movie.
Yeah, it really is unbelievable for the over-the-top performance, and the daddy issues that the killer has are just taken to the nth degree, where he has this soliloquy in front of a mirror where he is ridiculously ripped guy with his giant weightlifter arms.
I'm so sorry that I forget the name of this actor because he's wonderful. He was also in Darkman.
Yes.
Oh, he was so good. It's like, again, another Simpsons reference. You say ripped, I say...
barrel chest.
He's that wonderful mix of, was it chubby and muscular known as stocky, as Grandpa Simpson once said. He's a stocky fellow.
He's 70s ripped. And the other movie would be Barfly. Mm-hmm. Where you have been
able to save, and also Canon Production, believe it or not, they made
incredible. Yeah. And where you have like Frank Stallone as the bartender, and you have Henry Shinaski played by the wrestler himself, Mickey Rourke, and he's down on his luck, and he's hanging out in these bars and picking up women, very much like the woman in When a Stranger Calls. Mm-hmm. So just sort of haggard, worn. Yeah, when you ever are out on the town and you see one of them, it's quite interesting. So it's so rare to see like a middle-aged alcoholic woman drinking by herself, but I have, and when I have, it's been... It's something to behold.
So now is the time when I'm going to have to put you on the spot and ask you to do your Barfly impersonations. Because they're just awesome.
Oh, no.
Come on, at least do one. Don't leave us hanging.
I can take Eddie. All he needs is a sandwich. He's full of phony macho energy. I can take Eddie. How's that?
How about to my friends?
To my friends.
Fucking awesome.
Yeah, he's great movie. Yeah, eminently quotable, which this one really isn't. So... But yeah, if there would have been some way to improve it, again, just have the nix the sympathetic element, keep the escaped psycho killer, hell, make it more like Halloween and just keep the killings coming. Sometimes simple is best, and why mess with success? Mm-hmm. It's hard to sustain police procedurals, especially with nothing who the killer is.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Like, that's really weak.
And then it just, the tone shifted from one film to another film, and then back, it sort of circled back around to the original type of film. And it was, some of his tone shifts can be really, really unique and interesting and exciting, but this time it was just, it just made the middle third of the movie just completely puffy and superfluous. So,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but what's not superfluous, you're the one that always says this, but I'm doing it now, is our podcast. So
yes, exactly.
And our website.
It doesn't sag in the middle like some sort of, weighted down hammock.
Well, we keep it short.
Yeah, exactly.
So that they
don't
sag.
Like,
yeah. If it ever takes you longer to listen to a couple schmoes discussing a horror movie than it does for you to watch said movie, that's the wrong podcast.
Yeah.
Don't listen to that podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
Listen to our podcast.
Agreed.
We get you in, we get you out, and you have the rest of your day to do whatever the heck you want to do.
Exactly.
So if you want to run some errands, so be it.
Yes, for sure. And fire off movie suggestions, of course, reallawfulmovies@gmail.com, and we'll talk to you soon.
Take care.